everyone! I don't actually have any announcements today. Just wanted to say that your favorite unreliable narrators are both alive and well, and apologize deeply that this episode is a whole month late. We don't even have an excuse. But hey, nobody ever said that we were reliable. However, if you do want to encourage us to release our episodes on time, consider donating to our Patreon at patreon.com/unreliablenarratorspodcast for about the price of a cup of coffee. Then we could buy our own coffee. And maybe then we would stay awake for long enough to edit our episodes on time. Anyway, enjoy today's episode. When I look at this painting, I'll tell you about my initial impression. I don't like this painting.
How many different realities can we try to stuff into one moment?
Melting clocks.
So we can't ignore the egg.
Clocks don't melt.
Here is the place where the crooked meets the straight.
The most poetical thing in the world is not being sick.
There are no new words under the sun. There are no new notes I have left to hum. There are no new rhymes yet to be sung. There are no new chords that strings haven't strummed.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Unreliable Narrators, where we discuss media, literature, and the arts and how they relate to Christ, the self, and the world. I'm Sophie Beloncle.
And I'm Raymond Docapel.
And I'm Anna Mason.
Oh, hi, Anna.
Hello.
It's nice to see you again.
Thank you. It's nice to record with you guys again.
So you guys can guess that because we have Anna back on the podcast, that we are recruiting your help once more because we have to talk about art.
Yay.
Anna's like the genie that we call in. We rub the lamp three times whenever there's an art piece because we're hoping that her experience as an art major and as a lifelong art lover will help us forge our way. But Anna, you were saying that this particular art piece might also not be your main area of expertise.
Yes. Surrealism, this era, hasn't been something that I've done any deep dives into, so I'm excited to learn more about the piece and just input my critiques along the way.
Yeah, you will find that whenever you choose your major, people will project expertise on you and for the rest of your life, whether you like it or not. So, all right. Well, we both think that this art piece is a little bit weird, right, Sophie?
Yeah. So it's called The Persistence of Memory by Salvador Dali. And if you don't think you know by title what that painting is, the minute you Google it, you will immediately recognize it because there is nobody who has not seen this painting. Or if you haven't seen this painting, you for sure have seen one of the many parodies of this painting. So, but just in case you haven't, or in case you need your memory to be jogged as to what this painting is, it's the Melting Clocks painting. So you've got kind of a dark, brown, barren landscape with cliffs in the background. In the lower kind of left-hand corner, there's this brown table that looks like it's made of wood, but there aren't lots of details attached to it. And then on the table, there's like a tree, but it's literally just a small trunk with a branch coming out of it. And on the branch, there's a clock that's kind of melting down. It looks like a limp piece of cloth, basically. But it's a clock and it's melting off. And then we've got another clock kind of melting off the table. And then we've got a watch, like a pocket watch sort of thing, in the lower left-hand corner sitting on the table. And it's got a bunch of bugs, ants, maybe maggots on it that look like they're kind of eating the watch. And then we've got what, in my opinion, is the worst and most horrifying part of this painting, which is a thing that's kind of lying on the ground next to the table. It seems like it might be a dead animal. It definitely looks like it looks like biology of some kind. So it looks like it's living, but not anymore. It looks pretty dead.
And if you look closely, there's a giant eyelash on it. So it actually looks like it might be a big face. People have said that this is Dali's own self-portrait.
Yeah, so it looks kind of like a face in profile. It looks kind of like a weird, distorted, like, dead horse, like a seahorse, maybe. Yeah, it's got the long eyelashes protruding off of it. Something kind of sticking out of the what looks maybe like a mouth. That's kind of like a weird limp tongue sort of situation. pretty gross. And then, of course, on top, just to top it all off, on top of this weird dead thing, we've got another clock melting across its back. And that's pretty much the painting. Those are the big things that are important in it. When I look at this painting, I'll tell you about my initial impression. I don't like this painting. I have had a lifelong phobia, I guess, of cartoons, but not just any cartoon, like anything that looks kind of like reality, but just distorted. Basically, exactly the kind of thing that the melting clock is, or this weird sort of animal that you don't know what it is. Anything that's kind of psychedelic, distorted, something you might hallucinate if you're on LCD, whatever. Anything that seems like that, I hate. And that's including, like, old Mickey Mouse cartoons. Like, I can't stand this sort of thing. So, when I first saw this painting, when Raymond was like, let's do Persistence of Memory this week, I looked at it and went, oh no, I hate this painting.
So, you know, I think maybe your instincts might be, you might be onto something there, because in That Hideous Strength, which you really should read at some point, the main character, Mark Studdock, is forced to go through this series of examinations to initiate himself into this evil scientific organization. And one of the things that is he's forced to do is he's forced to sit in a room where everything is slightly off. Like the walls are not exactly at right angles. There's a bunch of dots on the table and they almost look like they correspond with dots on the ceiling. And he's like supposed to drive you mad trying to find the pattern. And then there's a series of paintings of famous like Renaissance paintings. Like there's the Mona Lisa, except there's a bunch of hair in her mouth. And there's the Last Supper, except there's a bunch of ants crawling underneath it. And the point of what the initiators are trying to get Mark to do is become desensitized to normalcy. And this culminates in trying to tell Mark to trample on a statue of the cross, which is very much like Silence vibes that we're getting here, Shusaku Endo vibes. And I won't tell you how that story ends, but you definitely get this feeling that this is the sort of territory you're in. So maybe, Sophie, you would escape the clutches of the NICE in Lewis's story, since you don't like this painting.
Yeah. I will take comfort in that. Anna, what do you think about it?
You know, I was freshly fascinated by this painting as I was re-looking at it for this podcast, and there definitely is a sense of lostness when you first look at it. I feel like that's probably a pretty universal like reaction to this view, just how wide open the landscape is. A couple of elements that you miss that I think are interesting is this large plane in the back here that is a hard shape is apparently a mirror. And very small in the background, I think it's easier to see when you're looking at it in person, there is a small white object in the light in front of the cliffs, and that apparently is an egg. So we can't ignore the egg because it is there.
Wait, where's the egg?
So the cliffs there in the light area, not the shadowed area, there's a small white speck with a shadow coming from. Do you see it?
There's an egg on the cliff?
No, it's in front of the cliff.
Oh.
Which I'm, you know, supposing probably represents rebirth or, you know, the continuance fertility of time or whatnot. But I was really fascinated thinking about this idea of the subconscious and how this painting's purpose is somewhat to illustrate a dreamscape or whatnot. And I just wanted to ask you guys, does this feel representative at all to you visually or in any sort of way of your like subconscious or any sort of dreamscape that you have encountered? Because for me, it doesn't at all. It feels completely unfamiliar. It's like, that is not like, there's so much going on in our subconscious, but I didn't feel like this visually or emotionally represented the feeling or like anything that I kind of could connect to about the subconscious or like a dream state. So I'm interested kind of in whether that's in some way a failure to connect with the audience or whether it's just very different for different people. Because like Sophie said, this is very unsettling and it's obviously meant to be. So it might be that there's just multifold goals with this painting, but
I think it's totally possible for you to induce this particular kind of dream state if you wanted to. I know that Salvador Dali was definitely influenced a lot by Sigmund Freud, and this is where at times when ideas of the subconscious or the unconscious was really taking off. But I think one of the mistakes that the Freudians made when they were talking about dreams and the subconscious is they seem to presume a lot of the times that you have absolutely no control over it. I think that there is an element, I think they got something right, and that is the fact that dreams do sort of expose a certain reality. They sort of relax, you're in a relaxed state of mind, so your mind is operating, and you need to be in a relaxed state of mind if you want to produce some sort of creative product. Trinity, Sophie's sister, who is a painter, has just told me once that when she's painting and she's very relaxed and she's wearing a device that monitors her heart rate, the device reads her as being asleep. Which, so I mean, like, that is absolutely integral to the creative process. You do have to be relaxed and let the mind sort of work on its own, the part of you that is not really totally awake. That all is true. But what I think Freud misunderstood is that you can actually have control over the sort of things that your unconscious mind produces. And case in point of this, Jordan Peterson has described a lot of the dreams that he's had, and he had a dream once where all of the world leaders bowed down to Christ. Now, do you think anyone would dream that dream? I don't think Sigmund Freud would dream that dream. I think he
only
dreamed
Jordan
that.
Peterson.
Yes, because his conscious mind was also thinking about those ideas. And he's studying this and he's trying to pull of these all these different ideas together in his waking life. What the dream does is it just consolidates those ideas.
I don't think anyone would dream that dream, but I think anyone could dream that dream. If you look to the Bible as an example, some people have dreamed some pretty strange dreams at God's behest.
Right. Well, that's exactly my point, is that if you want to dream a sort of Dali-esque landscape, all you have to do is sort of like engage yourself with that kind of material.
Just to interject one more thing, I think what I was trying to say more was this feels like a constructed space, which I think is an interesting juxtaposition with the exploration of the subconscious.
It does, it feels a little too much like still life. I don't know if that's what you're getting at.
Maybe.
Well, okay, so one thing I'll say before I talk about how sort of the method with which this painting was probably produced is that, like, when there are small children and we are going to watch, like, a scary movie or something like that, one of the reasons that we might say to the small child, like, you're not going to watch this movie, you're going to go to bed, you're going to watch something else, is the concern is that it's going to give them nightmares. And I think, Raymond, that maybe plays a little bit into what you were saying, which is that what you interact with when you're awake and what you're engaging your mind with is then going to affect your subconscious, which then affects the way that you dream. So if your subconscious and your dreams do look like this painting, maybe you watch too many scary movies, or maybe you're engaging with something else that is causing your subconscious to react in this way and to have this kind of dream. So Dali, right before he made this painting, the year before, I believe, he introduced something or started experimenting with something that he called the paranoiac critical method, which basically involved inducing a state of paranoia in order to produce art. And the paranoia was really important, like a state of not just fear, but the belief that everyone and everything is out to hurt you. Everyone is trying to destroy you. And it's unclear to us exactly, at least as far as I researched. If you're a listener and you know something that I don't, then let me know. But from what I could tell, we don't know for sure exactly what he did to induce paranoia, at least especially for this painting. I read that he definitely experimented with some different kinds of drugs. Raymond was saying earlier before we started recording that he read about the fact that he would like put himself in a very sleep-deprived state, which, as we all know, if you're sleep-deprived, then you might get a little bit paranoid, or you might get concerned about things that you might not otherwise be concerned about. But that's really fascinating to me, because when I look at this painting, I do immediately feel unsettled, and paranoia is kind of a good word for the way that it makes me feel. It makes me feel like someone or something is gonna hurt me, is the feeling that I get when looking at this painting. And it makes a lot of sense to me that someone like the artist would have to induce a state of paranoia in order to produce art of this kind. So just, I mean, not having talked about anything else other than that method, we haven't discussed anything else about Salvador Dali at this point. What do we think about that method? And does that shed any light on the way that we look at or interpret this painting?
It does seem... The emotion behind it kind of feels that, like, you know, tick, tick, time is running out, like, everything is gonna be bad sort of feeling. At the same time, there's a lot of tranquility present, so I am a little bit surprised that he had induced a state of paranoia in conceptualizing this work.
Well, he actually is constantly changing his story about where he gets the inspiration for this piece. He once described it as the inspiration for the melting clocks came from seeing melting cheese.
I read that.
And then later he said he was inspired by Einstein's theory of relativity. And then at another point, he says it symbolizes impotence because all the great world leaders were impotent. Case in point, Napoleon. So at this point, I'm beginning to think that he's just kind of full of it. I don't think he knows what he's talking about.
You know, I have been possibly told that sometimes that's the best way to be by my art professors. They're like, if people are putting meaning on stuff or asking you for your inspiration, it is okay to make stuff up.
That is funny. I think that the interesting thing is that culturally, this is one of the few art pieces from these very elitist artists that has really just totally become extremely widely known in popular culture. Because again, like, a lot of people are familiar with this painting. And the way it is almost always interpreted is Einstein's theory of relativity. In fact, that is the context in which the painting was first introduced to me. And so when I was trying to look up the painting, I was searching like Einstein clock painting, because that's what I thought it was associated with.
Now, I find that surprising, because obviously this is a very time is relative, like time can be bent, and that theory definitely is represented here, but there's so much of this memento mori, you know, the ants eating the watch and swarming, and the egg and the dead horse thing and the dead olive tree, and, you know, like, there's obviously this sort of life cycle, like a very strong life cycle, and time, you know, gets the best of every man message in this painting. So
it's interesting that you mention memento mori. Do you know who's considered the first surrealist painter?
No.
It's Hieronymus Bosch.
Oh my gosh. I like Hieronymus Bosch is the weirdest painter ever, but, like, definitely look at his paintings. They are wild. Garden of Earthly Delights. Wow.
Let's talk about that painting a little bit. So, because actually some of the figures in Dalí's paintings is actually considered to be directly copied from some of the islands, from an island or a cliff face in the Garden of Earthly Delights.
Interesting. I can see that.
And so, yes, the garden... So Hieronymus Bosch is this late Renaissance painter. I believe he was Italian? Let's see.
He is from the Netherlands.
Yes, he's Dutch from the Netherlands. But the Garden of Earthly Delights is this triptych. And in the first panel on the left side depicts the Garden of Eden. In the middle panel depicts what looks like some kind of earthly paradise, with a bunch of nude figures enjoying various sensual pleasures. Although it's not very, it's erotic, but it's not explicit. And then in the third panel is a depiction of hell, which is arguably one of the most powerful of the panels, at least artistically speaking, in which the eroticism is kind of stripped away totally from the nude figures, and now they're just suffering. And the imagery is so strange because there's a lot of mechanical objects in hell, like musical instruments, for example, strange tubes and tanks, water tanks. It looks very futuristic. And of course, a lot of science fiction art and surrealist art takes a lot of inspiration from Bosch. And the strange thing is that people don't really know where he got these images from, because there wasn't really any kind of precedent for these kinds of strangely mechanical objects that are in the painting. But I think one of the things that we can say about it, I mean, this was... Again, the strange world of the medieval Renaissance, which we've talked about in the Seventh Seal, that medieval Europe was a very strange place because it was a strange sort of combination of Christianized paganism, or maybe paganized Christendom. And so this is definitely, there's definitely pictures and images in the Garden of Earthly Delights that seem to be alluding to biblical accounts, but are definitely extra biblical. There are pictures that just can't seem to be cross-referenced to anything in the Bible. But what is clear about the painting is that there is progression towards hell from the very beginning. So the point is that humanity was doomed from the beginning. There's lustful figures doing things that they shouldn't do. There's a woman with cherries on top of her head in the middle panel, which is the earthly delight panel. And cherries at that time represented pride. So one of the things that it's representing is that there is already corruption. There's already the beginnings of hell before you already get to hell. And I think that it is important that we talk about this painting as being the beginning of surrealism, because the surrealists are always telling you that, you know, they're not telling you where they're coming from, and they try to pretend that all of this is just springing from the spontaneous wells of their creative spirit, when clearly they had a model that they were drawing this from, and the model that they were drawing this from was literally just a depiction of hell. So paranoia, like, well, that seems to be an appropriate emotion that they're trying to induce. Like, maybe they are just trying to induce the state of mind that you have when you're in hell.
That's really interesting to me in the context of talking about this painting as associated with Einstein's theory of relativity, because, and this is, you know, I'm thinking way back to classes I took a long time ago, so this is not fresh information that I just learned or anything like that, but my general understanding of, like, the trajectory of contemporary philosophy and moral thinking is that Einstein's theory of relativity made a big splash, not just in the scientific world, when it really is a scientific idea, right? It also affected the way that people saw morality and philosophy and theology, that if there are things in the physical world, in physics, that are relative and are not fixed and absolute, sort of, you know, like way back when the Christian world thought that all the orbits of all the planets had to be perfect circles and that the heavens had to be perfect and that that was a sign of God being absolute and morality being absolute. And then it turns out, well, they're actually not perfect circles. And that makes kind of a problem because we thought that the world was this way and that that was a sign of God's perfection. And now we don't think that anymore. We know that that's not true. And so how do we rethink about God in order to accommodate that new thing we know about the world? And from, you know, from what I remember, Einstein's theory of relativity was sort of the same way. So I think that this painting is interesting given when Dali painted it. I think it was 1931 was the exact year. That's kind of at the time when all this is happening, when there's this concern that reality and morality and truth is no longer absolute. Maybe it's all relative because we know about the theory of relativity. And I think we see a little bit of a microcosm of that dilemma in this painting because the clocks are all melting and physics are not behaving as they would in the real world, right? So we have ants, we have bugs eating at metal. So it's like the metal is decomposing like flesh would. That obviously is not the way that metal behaves in the real world. That's not physically true. Melting clocks. Clocks don't melt. At least not like this. They wouldn't be draped over a branch or over a dead creature in the way that this is. The dead creature, like, isn't anything that we would actually see in the real world. It also kind of looks like a face. It's got super weird, long, horrific eyelashes, that sort of thing. And yet, despite the fact that everything in this painting, we could say, is non-absolute, it's relative in the sense that anything goes, this is not a depiction of the real world, it is following some basic rules of artistic construction of painting. The table has correct perspective. The angles, you know, hit where they're supposed to. The clock actually looks like it's melting off the table, and it actually looks like it's melting off the branch. It's following the rules of physics in that way. The colors of the painting all work together. It's clearly composed in a way that is intentional, that's meant to draw your eye to particular things. The cliffs in the background are actually really pretty. They look like real cliffs, and I believe what I read is that they look like the cliffs in the distance from where Dali was born in Spain. So those are real cliffs that he grew up near, that he saw. So I think it's interesting that if the painting is evoking this sense of everything is relative, we are unmoored, God is dead, what are we going to do? If that's true, if that's something that the painting is evoking, it is simultaneously evoking order, that there is some kind of, there are some absolute rules that we're still following, even in this paranoiac state that Salvador Dali is painting in.
That is very interesting. I think that's what I was trying to comment on earlier, saying this is such a constructed space. Like, there is something very real world about this. And although that's true in our dreams as well, right? A lot of times there are things happening in our dreams that are just so much more far outside of the realm of possibility than what is depicted in most surrealist artworks that are focused on the subconscious. And I was thinking this morning, like, of course there's a movement where there are creatives trying to tap into this subconscious reality thing because it's interesting. I mean, we've all sat and thought, like, how bizarre the things that come out of our minds when we're sleeping or even just zoned out and thinking and letting our minds run, the visual aspect of our mind. Like, but there's something so counterfeit to that about this image for me. I think that's kind of what we're discussing. And because it doesn't feel like real imagination. It has that kind of hellish aspect to it. Like, there's something deeply wrong.
Right, right. So it's kind of like a little bit of like a counterfeit order, you could say. Like it has the semblance of order to it, but maybe it's trying to threaten you with chaos underneath of it. And so, again, going back to like medieval art and depictions of hell in medieval times, I think that it's very interesting that you see a very similar imagery popping up in Dante's Inferno that looks very similar, at least, even though if you were to picture it, it would look, I think, very similar to Bosch's depiction of hell. And what I mean by that is, well, here's a couple examples. So if I think it's somewhere in the 6th or 7th circle, Dante encounters these trees. And Virgil breaks off a branch and the trees scream because this is the circle of the suicides. And in the punishment for people who commit suicide in hell is because you have denied the sacredness of your body, the image of God. You are denied a body in the afterlife. So all of their souls are put inside trees. So picture that image in your mind. It's like semi-human like faces pasted onto trees. Does this not look very surrealist already? And then there's another instance in which Virgil says that they're going to cross a bridge later at another circle. And then when they arrive there, the bridge is never there. And so the commentator, Dorothy Sayers, commented on this, and her argument was that this is not just because Dante forgot. What he wanted to do is to indicate that hell is always appearing to be organized, but it actually isn't. So we have, like, you know, 33 cantos and, you know, these couplets that are all very organized, but underneath it, hell doesn't keep its promises, and there's chaos.
Also, it's interesting to note that the light sources on the table, which you mentioned, Sophie, was one of the more physics-compliant aspects of this painting, is very weird. For the melting clock, the light source seems to be coming from about where the water level is. For the top of the table, it's directly overhead. For the tree, it's off to the right. For the side, there's a light source except for behind the clock, which then indicates maybe the light source is where the viewer is, and except for that there's this large shadow over where the pocket watch is, except for the pocket watch is not in shadow. So there is, and obviously Dali was a very accomplished draftsman and knew all of these things that I know, and he did that on purpose. So I think that that must have been somewhat of to accentuate the feeling of this place isn't real. This is not happening. However, oh, it is real. And, you know, how many different realities can we try to stuff into one moment? And I think that's the chaos that we feel in our own minds as we interpret the world coming at us, both from the internal and the external. The times when you feel the most chaotic is when you're trying to accept what's happening to you from multiple viewpoints of reality. Okay, maybe this is real, maybe this is real, maybe this is real all at once, and you're trying to unify them, and you just start to feel a bit panicked because you know that they can't unify and there's something missing in your picture. And I think that's part of what evokes that deep sense of unease.
There's a great Calvin and Hobbes comic strip, which is done in, I think, like, sort of, sort of style, where Calvin says, like, Bill Watterson's just having fun drawing these sort of neo-cubist artwork. But the story goes that Calvin, it all started when Calvin began to have an argument with his dad. Until he began to see both sides of the argument, and then he began to see both sides of everything. And so all of the perspective is all warped and messed up.
Exactly.
And then the final frame is it snaps back into reality, and Calvin walks up and says, "You're still wrong, Dad."
I also love the time flies joke. I think we need to not ignore that. There is a fly on one of these watches.
Oh.
Oh. I did not notice that.
I didn't either.
So in that, it's just kind of like, oh, haha, you know, this is not serious, except it is.
I think that another thing I was noting, so I mean, I've just been staring at this painting the whole time as we've been talking, and it suddenly occurred to me that the weird dead creature, the dead horse thing, had started to just be normal for me. Like, I wasn't thinking about that anymore as something that was weird. And then I kind of had to snap back to the fact that, oh, that's really disturbing. I don't know what this thing is. It doesn't look like anything real. Like, my brain had already kind of adjusted to, like, this is just another creature, I guess. Maybe that really is... Maybe I can kind of imagine it as a dead horse, and then it's fine. It's just this, like, dead thing. I don't know if that's at all any of the intention behind the painting. But I do think it's interesting to note that we can make ourselves adjust to almost anything, and that we can accept almost anything as just part of the real world if we just stare at it for long enough.
You're becoming desensitized, Sophie. This is bad.
I did watch an entire anime from beginning to end, and that was, you know, that was tough, but I think that maybe helped a little bit. I'm working on it.
I mean, I think that's one part. Something we haven't talked about yet is why people are attracted to this art form. Actually, this is my husband's favorite work of art, classical work of art ever. And he loves it. And a lot of people actually really love it, and they love this kind of work. And it's not that they don't sense the unease. It's they do. It just is cool to them in whatever way. And also, it's very interesting because there's a lot more to look at and interpret than in most classical artwork. The average Joe can look at this painting and be like, oh, I can interact with this because I see a dead horse laying on the ground. And maybe your mom next to you is like, oh, I saw the profile. You know, kind of the same conversation that we've been having. And there's this exploration that you can actually do into the painting, and there is a coolness here. There's a coolness factor to this painting, I think, at least. You know, there are clocks you can get that are actually, like, that you can put on your mantle that are that little melted clock replica, and I think that's kind of cool. I mean, in one sense, it's just like an art reference in everyday life, which is always kind of cool. But what do you guys think about that, about the popularity of this piece?
When I think about, like, my own personal approach to art, I definitely take the Apostle Paul's words pretty seriously when he says, whatever is true, whatever is good, whatever is lovely, whatever is of good repute, you should think.
So it's Uncle Screwtape,
which
is
what
you're
saying. Which seems to be a good argument to say that you should probably pursue artworks that are edifying and not deliberately meant to make you uncomfortable and unsettle you. But let's kind of like flip the argument a little bit here. Let's say that you are, you know, let's look at this from the perspective of a villain, from a sort of a person whose goal is literally just to destroy order. Like, maybe that's the, like, imagine you're an artist, that kind of artist, and there are plenty of artists like that. Yeah, Uncle Screwtape, like, I'm just going to flip this around, and I'm literally just going to try to produce art that insults beauty, insults order, insults good things, any sort of semblance of a pattern I'm deliberately trying to upset. Let's say that I go about approaching that. I think that one of the things that happens as a result of that is that I actually, when I'm engaging with that kind of art piece, I actually love order more, and I love beauty more, and I'm more attracted to it as a result of having to engage in all the ways that something is wrong. So in some sense, there is something to be said with engaging with extremely disturbing art pieces, because it serves as a reminder of what you decide, what actually is orderly and what actually does make sense. And and sort of appreciating it at a deeper level. And this goes back to what I was talking about, this interesting scene in That Hideous Strength with the character Mark Studdock, who is being exposed to all of these surrealist art pieces. And obviously, and this is the interesting thing about that scene, is that obviously the intention of these art pieces was to make Mark Studdock be seduced by ugliness and to not care anymore, to be desensitized to these things. But what Lewis is saying is that the great irony of this scene is that it had the exact opposite effect on him. And I now will spoil the end of what happened at the story. What? So when Mark was being told to tread on the cross, he says that, the Lewis's narration, he says, like, all this time he's looking at crookedness, and even though it was intended to make him forget about the straightness, about straight things, it actually made him love those things more, love things that are normal. And then when he's looking at the cross, he says, here is the place where the crooked meets the straight. It is a cross. And then at that point, he turns to the guy who's trying to make him step on it, and he says, it's all bloody nonsense, and I'm damned if I ever do such a thing. And that was his first heroic and brave act in the novel.
It's so British. I love it.
It's so British, yeah.
So I want to take a second and maybe take a step back and talk about Salvador Dali a little bit before we run out of time here, because there are two big things from his life that I want to talk about that I think are philosophically interesting and maybe shed a little bit of light on what's going on with this painting. So, taking a step way back, some interesting fun facts about Salvador Dali. We referenced earlier the fact that he was born in Spain,
they had a formal art education.
He was raised Catholic, like he was born into a Catholic family, but his father was an anti-clerical atheist, so his father was not religious, he was not Catholic. And it seems like probably he was sort of born into a faith that he never really truly adopted, and he just kind of lapsed as he got older. But he started moving to surrealism as he grew more proficient in art. He joined the surrealist group in 1929, which I didn't know this before. Apparently the surrealist group was like an organized society that I think is a little bit maybe, yeah, like it's under, I think it's a little bit undermining the idea of what surrealism is. It's a little bit too orderly if you have a society that you can accept people into and kick them out of. But so, and then 1930 is about when he starts inducing psychotic hallucinations so that he can create art. Then the year later, 1931, that's when he completes The Persistence of Memory, which is probably his most famous painting, and maybe the most famous surrealist painting, although obviously there's not really an objective way to measure that. So here's the thing that I think is super interesting that I want to zero in on for a second and talk about. So in the late 1930s, the surrealist group actually expelled Dali. They got rid of him. They kicked him out. Because they said, the reason is so interesting to me, they said that his over-refinement of his paranoid critical method was too structured. They said it was a repudiation of surrealist automatism. So automatism is this idea that, like, your art, if you're a surrealist, really truly has to come from the subconscious. Like, it's like automatic writing, right? Like, you just create and you can't explain it. It's just coming out of your subconscious. And they thought that his method was too orderly. He was too structured for them. And so they kicked him out. And by 1941, he was announcing the death of the surrealist movement and the return of classicism. So he gave up on surrealism after that, started kind of attacking it publicly after they kicked him out. And they were like, yeah, you're too orderly. What do we think about that? Does that shed any light on what we've been saying so far about how this painting maybe seems a little too structured? It's a little too clear in its pun about the fly on the clock and maybe a little bit too structured, too orderly.
Yeah, I think that is its fatal flaw as a surrealist art, is that we actually can talk about it. and mm-hmm. and make sense out of it.
Yeah, he definitely had a plan, although I think there's a lot more you can get out of it than necessarily was his plan, which is true of all art, really.
It's very interesting that...
Right, but even the fractals,
like, again, this goes are back
symmetrical.
To, like, if you were to set out to be Uncle Screwtape and just deliberately sow seeds of chaos, can right. you actually succeed? Can you create something that is truly chaotic and meaningless? Or is it actually inevitable that you are going to have to place or impose some sort of semblance of meaning and order in order for even the chaos right. to mean anything?
Of course, my biologist mind is going like, well, if you go down deep enough, everything is formed out of fractals. that's what I'm saying, is everything is ordered. There is no physical thing that isn't ordered at some level.
And so I think that is the thing about surrealist art, which I think actually can be very Pauline and in the spirit of Paul, because you can be the sort of person who is always trying to cover up chaos, and by only focusing on things that are clean and orderly and beautiful, and if you cover that up, then actually what you might end up achieving in effect is the opposite of that. Because then you're just hiding all of the things that are wrong underneath it. And that may actually end up being a more atheistic position, because you're saying that underneath all of this beauty is just chaos. But if instead you start from the opposite point of view and you focus on the chaos, then part of what you're doing in effect as an artist is you're questioning the reality of that. You're saying maybe this chaos isn't actually real, and maybe there is something beautiful hiding underneath that if we look deeper. It's the difference between chasing a sunset, right? Chasing the light when you know that you can't overtake the night, and turning around and running into the dark, knowing that if you run in the opposite direction, that's where the sun is going to rise.
I think that if I have a thesis about surrealist art at this point, it is that it seems self-defeating to me. Because I think the situation that Salvador Dali, I think, ran into is that he was too much of an artist. The problem wasn't that he wasn't a good surrealist, it was that he was too good of an artist and he cared too much about the art. And he had too much of an eye for what was good and beautiful. And that was a problem. That meant that even though he was trying to be a surrealist, he actually, insofar as he was an artist, had difficulty being a real surrealist. And I actually have a passage that I'm going to read part of from a book by Chesterton that I think maybe shed some light on that idea. The book is called The Man Who Was Thursday. Really, this is from the very first scene, so there's almost no background you need to know. The only thing you really need to know is that Chesterton is writing this novel at a time when being an anarchist is basically equivalent to being a terrorist. So an anarchist wants everything to be destroyed. He wants the whole world to be burned down. He wants everything to be chaotic. An anarchist would be a fan of surrealist art, basically. So you have in this first scene, this character who is an anarchist, whose name is Lucian Gregory. So he'll be referred to as Gregory during this passage. And then another character who is a poet, who calls himself the Poet of Law and Order, who actually turns out to be a police detective, and his name is Gabriel Symes. So in this first scene, they're having this argument about whether or not poetry is based in order or whether it's based in chaos. And this is, I'll kind of excerpt this opening passage. So we start out with Lucian Gregory, who's the anarchist poet, talking. "An artist is identical with an anarchist," he cried. "You might transpose the words anywhere. An anarchist is an artist. The man who throws a bomb is an artist because he prefers a great moment to everything. He sees how much more valuable is one burst of blazing light, one peal of perfect thunder, than the mere common bodies of a few shapeless policemen. An artist disregards all governments, abolishes all conventions. The poet delights in disorder only. If it were not so, the most poetical thing in the world would be the underground railway." "So it is," said Mr. Syme. Nonsense, cried Gregory, who was very rational when anyone else attempted paradox. Why do all the clerks and navvies and the railway trains look so sad and tired, so very sad and tired? I will tell you. It is because they know that the train is going right. It is because they know that whatever place they have taken a ticket for, that place they will reach. It is because after they have passed Sloane Square, they know that the next station must be Victoria, and nothing but Victoria. Oh, their wild rapture, oh, their eyes like stars, and their souls again in Eden, if the next station were unaccountably Baker Street. It is you who are unpoetical, replied the poet Syme. If what you say of clerks is true, they can only be as prosaic as your poetry. The rare, strange thing is to hit the mark. The gross, obvious thing is to miss it. We feel it is epical when men, with one wild arrow, strike a distant bird. Is it not also epical when man, with one wild engine, strikes a distant station? Chaos is dull, because in chaos the train might indeed go anywhere, to Baker Street or to Baghdad. But man is a magician, and his whole magic is this, that he does say Victoria, and lo, it is Victoria. No, take your books of mere poetry and prose. Let me read a timetable with tears of pride. And then, I'm gonna skip kind of to the end here. Gregory says, and even then, we poets always ask the question, and what is Victoria now that you have got there? You think Victoria is like the New Jerusalem. We know that the New Jerusalem will only be like Victoria. Yet the poet will be discontented even in the streets of heaven. The poet is always in revolt. There again, said Syme irritably, what is there poetical about being in revolt? You might as well say that it is poetical to be seasick. Being sick is a revolt. Both being sick and being rebellious may be the wholesome thing on certain desperate occasions, but I'm hanged if I can see why they are poetical. Revolt in the abstract is revolting. It's mere vomiting. It is things going right that is poetical. Our digestions, for instance, going sacredly and silently right, that is the foundation of all poetry. Yes, the most poetical thing, more poetical than the flowers, more poetical than the stars, the most poetical thing in the world is not being sick.
I feel like that sums it up pretty well. To quote another Chesterism, poets have been mysteriously silent on the subject of cheese.
They have to paint melting clocks instead of melting cheese.
Yes.
Yeah, it was a melting cheese originally, so there you go. He should have just drawn the melting cheese. That was the real miracle.
I think there is something legitimately redeeming about this piece of art, like in this piece of art. I do not think that if Uncle Screwtape was to try to make a piece of art, this is what he would come up with. I think there are legitimate reasons to be interested and even like this piece of artwork, even with everything that we've discussed. And I think that it has a lot to do with that passage you just read and what Raymond said about how seeing emptiness or lostness or paranoia in a sense where there is order and you can analyze it and you can think about it and you can see the broken olive tree and you can say there's something dead and not right about that broken olive tree, and it will bring to mind the right things. And that this painting actually does that in a fairly active way. So I think that's my final new opinion on this piece of artwork that I never thought about before in my life, is that it is not devoid of worth.
Well, it's interesting that Dali actually wrote a sequel, painted a sequel to this painting.
I saw that. Yes. It had to do with molecular biology, apparently. Everything breaking down into its molecular form.
Yeah, let's take a second to talk about that. So the other interesting thing about Dali's life is that basically around the same time, so he is kicked out of the Surrealist group, right? They say, you're too orderly, you can't be here anymore. He starts criticizing Surrealism. And in 1941, he starts saying, Surrealist movement is dead, classicism is here to stay. And then in 1948, he announces his return to the Catholic faith. So whether or not that is a true return, you know, I don't know. I couldn't tell you. But what I can tell you is that his art after his return to the Catholic faith, a lot of it is a lot more structured and I think beautiful than his art up to that point. I think we probably don't have time to talk about all of these religious paintings. But he painted a portrait of the Madonna, so Mary with the baby Jesus that is really beautiful, I think, but also beautiful in kind of an abstract way. He still uses some of those same techniques of calling attention to the shapes of what's going on in the painting, not painting just like an actual total realistic portrait, but the painting doesn't make me, it doesn't freak me out. It doesn't horrify me in the same way that The Persistence of Memory does. It actually is calming for me to look at. He also painted the Christ of St. John on the cross, which is a painting of Christ on the cross from a really kind of extreme upward angle. I think it's also really beautiful, and I think the lighting and the dramatic angle calls attention to the crucifixion in a way that, you know, other paintings might not. And then, of course, we have the disintegration of the Persistence of Memory, which he painted after he sort of got interested in what he called nuclear mysticism. So nuclear mysticism is basically this idea that all matter has a nature that humans are unable to see or comprehend. So he was interested in like quantum physics and the atom, especially after the dropping of the atom bomb at the end of World War II. And he was so interested in this idea that there is nature and there is matter, but that there is a reality in that nature and in that matter that is beyond what you can see when you look at that matter. So if we look at the disintegration of the Persistence of Memory, we can see that it's similar, it's a similar painting, but that there are these little squares, like boxes that are kind of down on the plane underneath that are sort of being pulled apart, that the tree that the clock was hanging on is being pulled apart, it's broken in pieces, that the clock is kind of flying off the table, we don't have the watch with the little bugs on it anymore, there's like a fish in the corner. For, I don't know why it's there. I actually couldn't interpret that part for you. And the weird creature thing is still there, but like a little bit of a different angle, and it's almost kind of falling off of the portrait. Like it's not really in the painting anymore. And then right above that, there's another clock, like a kind of melted clock that is very clearly broken. You can see through the clock. So when we look at this painting, are we able to see anything about, like anything in Salvador Dali's change in perspective over the years between he induced hallucinations and painted The Persistence of Memory, and then after he returned to the Catholic faith, after he renounced surrealism and got to this point where he painted this painting, do we see any of that in the painting?
I would venture the interpretation that the disintegration of the persistence of memory is actually much more optimistic than the first one. I mean, the absence of ants is one thing, but when you look at the first painting, it looks like it's happening at sunset, right? But this one, you could say it looks like it's sunrise because mm-hmm. it's much brighter. You feel like the sense of something is impending, something is coming, rather than something is leaving us. And there's a little bit more rigidity to it. And yeah, also looking at the painting of Saint Mary, I think that her face is really interesting because it looks like, you know, a sort of an older, mm-hmm. serene woman, which is not something that I would expect to see, like, that sort of character emerging in Dali's painting.
Yeah, in the disintegration of the Persistence of Memory, there's an interest and a curiosity and even a certain amount of playfulness present that's just completely not in the other painting. I think this one still gives you the sense of the circle of life, things forming, coming apart, creating new. I think it's amazing that he was so interested in this quantum physics type of stuff and was also painting about it, because those are two very, you know, separated disciplines usually. But it is a very fascinating thing. And I'm really curious whether the fish is some sort of reference to evolutionary theory, or I don't know. Mm. It's a really weird painting, but I definitely like it better than the other one. The colors are really nice. Also, the lighting schema is unified, which mm-hmm. is just really nice for me.
I think there's definitely a sense, even though things feel like they're coming apart, in this painting. Like, the tree is kind of breaking apart. I think part of what makes this painting satisfying for me is that it feels like the things that are coming apart are the things that unsettled me from the first painting. This melting clock over here is breaking. Actually, both the clocks. Is every clock breaking? Two of them at least are breaking. Oh no, all of them are breaking because the hand on the one on the tree is very clearly coming off.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little, like, knob at the top that is falling off of the one on the tree. It feels like the unsettling dead creature is not front and center. It's being pushed away or kind of carted away.
It's also kind of cute now.
Yeah, true.
It looks like it could swim around and be your friend.
And all these little boxes, they think maybe are supposed to represent atoms. I couldn't really tell you, but they're all structured, they're all orderly, and they're all underneath. They're underneath everything that's breaking apart. So I think that there's this sense of all that was unsettling at sunset and the other painting is kind of coming apart to be made new now, perhaps. And then underneath it all, we've got structure and we've got order in the matter that is underlying. And then, of course, there's the fact that his whole idea of, I forget now what it's called, natural mysticism, what was it called? Nuclear mysticism, is the idea that matter has a nature that humans are unable to see or comprehend, that there is something more to reality. And from this painting, I don't think that the something more is hostile or unsettling or something that you should be afraid of, that there is maybe something more to reality and that something more is actually beautiful and optimistic. And I think it's amazing. I think it's fascinating that that comes after his return to the Catholic faith.
There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in.
And I think that it's really indicative of how much darkness there really is in the original painting that we all feel so relieved when it begins to disintegrate. When that mindset and that imagery and that reality starts to become something else.
Well, good on you, Dolly.
Thanks, Salvador.
I mean, I can definitely see why this is a famous painting.
Thanks for listening.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, so I guess do we like surrealism now?
I don't.
I gotta look at more surrealism. Apparently, this is not real surrealism, apparently.
Yeah, we gotta go look at the people who kicked out Salvador Dali. If he wasn't surrealist enough for them.
I think the conclusion is that surrealism isn't real. It actually never existed.
So true. All categories are constructed.
Well, thanks for being joining us again, Anna.
Yeah.
We hope that we'll find more art pieces for us to talk about. But thank you for listening, everyone.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week or next month. Or will we?
You never know.
We don't know.
You've been listening to Unreliable Narrators, a Mars Hill podcast. Unreliable Narrators is an original podcast produced by Raymond Docapil and Sophie Belunkel. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever podcasts can be found. If you enjoyed this podcast, please rate us, review us, write to us at unreliablepodcasters@gmail.com or support us on Patreon at patreon.com/unreliablenarratorspodcast. Shout out to our Paradiso level patron, Amy Klomperens. Our theme song is New Moon by Caleb Klomperens. In our next episode, we'll be discussing the 1834 poem by Samuel Taylor Coleridge, The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Until then, if you happen to stumble across a desolate landscape with melting clocks and strange eggs and gross dead things on the ground, don't worry. It's all disintegrating anyway.
I know you can see something inside, the one part of me that I cannot hide. And maybe it's true that nothing is new, but I can see so much more in you. There are no new words under the sun.
There